Well, good morning. This is Per Fograng, and the show is Fight the Empire. And my guest is James Howard Kunstler, who is a author of many books on peak oil and economic collapse. He's also written a series of novels called A World Made by Hand, and the last volume in that series is out right now. So, Jim Kunstler, welcome to KBOO.
Nice to be here, Per Fograng.
Well, gee whiz. I hate to put that book down. You know, I mean, it was a series of four novels, and but it's over with now. The story's over, sort of.
Well, the last book of the series is being published this week.
That's right. Yes.
Called The Harrows of Spring.
Yeah. Tell us what that means.
Well, it's a reference to the breaking of the soil in the spring for replanting, but also the difficulties and vicissitudes of life. So my characters are living in a kind of post-economic collapse American future, and the workings of daily life have changed quite a bit, although American culture is still recognizably American culture. But the terms of daily life are much harsher and more challenging than they were. The electricity's not on anymore. Internet is gone. Phones aren't ringing. And people have to struggle to get by. And that's what's going on in these novels, you know, along with a lot of other incidents and dramatic things that I've cooked up to illustrate what may be the place that we're going to.
Well, I might say that this is not in the distant future. It's maybe, a couple decades from now, because most of these people remember what life was like before the collapse.
Oh, yeah. I very consciously set the action in the not-distant future, and I was a little cute about stating exactly when it was, because I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to do that. So, but we can assume that it's in the not distant future. And, you know, there are an awful lot of things going on right now that I think are making Americans nervous about how, you know, the path that we're going down.
Well, tell us about this town. It's in upstate New York, kind of in the upper Hudson Valley, not far from the...
Yeah, the fictional town of Union Grove in Washington County, New York, is in the piece of territory between the Hudson River and the Vermont border, and it's an old factory mill. You know, it's an old mill town that had several factories, which are now all defunct, of course. And that whole industrial economy is gone. And the town is in this last of the four books, The Harrows of Spring. This town has become sore beset by the arrival of a group of people from nearby Massachusetts who style themselves as the Berkshire People's Republic. And they've come to try to make a political association with them, but in fact they're actually grifters who are trying to grift the town and all of its people out of their accumulated silver in exchange for paper dollars.
That's an interesting concept, because that's sort of what's going on now with, I guess, the Federal Reserve.
Kind of is, exactly.
Yes,
it is. And so this is a kind of an illustration of how that grift works on the much smaller scale. But yeah, we're in a strange situation in America. And I think the core of it really is that the techno-industrial fiesta that we've been enjoying, like many things in history, is a thing that has a beginning and middle and an end. And we're closer to the end of it than we are to the middle of it. And we have no idea how we're going to carry it on. We've been trying to compensate for our inability to continue growing it by piling up debt. And that's beginning to not work anymore, because the instruments that represent debt, like bonds and promissory notes and mortgages and things like that, are beginning to fail. So, you know, we face a pretty stringent situation with American finance, and by extension, with the American economy. And we're at a kind of inflection point now, which I think is expressing itself most colorfully in the political arena.
Well, it's interesting that the interest rates are so low, you know, like sort of the financial advisors tell us, you know, you've got to save up for your retirement. We're being told to save money for retirement. We're also told to spend money to keep the consumer thing going. You can't do both. And and with the interest rates so low, where do you put your money where it'll give you any return at all? Now they even have negative interest rates. You have to actually pay the bank to store your money for you.
So that, you know, ordinary citizens can't earn any return on their savings accounts or the bonds that they buy. But it also, unfortunately, has even greater repercussions institutionally in organizations like pension funds and insurance companies. You know, insurance companies and pension funds can't survive unless they invest money in safe investments that yield, you know, 7%, 8% revenue a year. And they can't do that anymore. So they've been shoved more and more into risky investments. And, you know, I think that the inflection point is arriving for them, too, that they can't pretend to be able to successfully carry on these ventures anymore. But, you know, the American culture right now generally is you know, lying to itself and pretending that we can keep on living exactly the way we've been living. And it's understandable because we've invested hugely in a set of arrangements that don't have very good prospects. But we can't imagine letting go of them. You know,
well,
that's sort of the big problem.
Well, let's get back to Union Grove. I mean, there's, you know, people have survived all the carnage of the collapse because they're kind of isolated where they are. And you have sort of, it seems to me, there's this three ways of surviving in this kind of new economy. There's, you know, the town itself kind of operates on sort of, oh, I don't know, libertarian market principles, you know, people do their jobs and they trade and swap things. Then you have this sort of feudalism represented by this Stephen Bullock, who has this big plantation where he takes in people and he gives them security and puts them to work, and it's pretty prosperous, although he rules with an iron hand. And then you have this kind of like a, I guess sort of like a commune run by kind of a southern revivalist or something, Brother Job.
No, it's a religious cult.
Yes, well, but they sort of operate like a commune in some ways.
Well, yeah, they do. They're you know, at the center of the book is this one particular group, the New Faith Covenant Brotherhood Church of Jesus. And I'm not a religious person personally, but I thought it would be interesting to, you know, to bring them into the picture. And they remained in the picture for all four books and became very important players in that. And what they've done is they've purchased the old high school, which is no longer being used for a number of reasons, and they're setting up a kind of, you know, what they call their New Jerusalem headquarters there. And they interact with the townspeople, and as the books go on, the people of the town and the people of this group have more and more, you know, things that they do together. And this cult has arrived from Virginia to escape the disorders of Dixieland that are depicted in the book, or at least averred to often. And so they move north, looking for some peace and tranquility and a place to settle down, and they picked this little town in upstate New York. And my, you know, my purpose there was to kind of suggest that there would be a conflict in the future between the way people, different groups of people, perceived the world and perceived reality. And for some, you know, the world would become kind of supernaturally re-enchanted. And for others, they would be left disappointed and let down by the promises of technology and really all the baggage of science and empiricism and the Enlightenment. So, you know, that's sort of the a constant argument that's going on in the book between these two groups. You know, one of them is basically faith-based, and the other one is kind of science and reality-based, and the latter group feels pretty let down because technology didn't rescue them, and they've been. What's really happened is that the developed industrial world has kind of gone medieval.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a kind of an enormous economic reset to an earlier level of living, and they've lost a lot. So that's what's going on in Union Grove.
Well, at the same time, it's interesting. Some of the technology early in the book, where this hotel, the New Faith people build this hotel for the town, and they have this huge. It's kind of like those old-fashioned Russian stoves, the Russian oven.
Yeah, they heat the place with a big masonry stove.
Yeah, it's this big pile of brick with all these channels where the heat kind of gets absorbed and it stays there for all day long,
Well, when we say hotel, also, this is not like a Trump hotel,
No.
This is like a four-story building.
Mm-hmm,
with like 25 rooms in it. But I am trying to illustrate that if we were to undergo that kind of severe change, that there are ways of doing things that we know about that can allow us to continue living comfortably. But we probably won't be doing them until we're dragged kicking and screaming into that new disposition of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, the town is I have to say, when you describe the people's meals, they eat pretty well,
Well, that's true, they're probably eating better than the poor slobs who are out there in the supermarket buying Hot Pockets,
Mm-hmm.
Food now in the novel has to be produced locally, and it has to be pretty fresh, or it has to be preserved and locally, and. I put a good deal of attention into describing their meals for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think that you get to readers through their, through their senses.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do that. But, one of the agendas of writing this series of novels was to sort of get across the idea to people that if we were to go through such a traumatic change in American life and economy, that we would actually benefit a lot from it in some ways. It would put us back into living in real communities.
Mm-hmm.
Where people had real obligations and duties to each other. And all the canned entertainment would be kind of swept away. They'd have to make music with their neighbors and
mm-hmm.
and they would have to find ways and this would be a world that would also include joy and satisfaction and interesting things to do and ways of getting on in the world and love and romance and all of the things that the human pageant really requires, but we certainly wouldn't be distracting ourselves with iPhones and Pop-Tarts anymore.
Well, I'm glad to say that tater tots survive. People still eat tater tots.
Tater tots survives as a remnant, a remnant piece of culture from the old days, although now it's homemade.
Well, I think of tater tots as kind of like miniature knishes,
Yeah, it's a kind of a little kind of potato puff thing.
Mm-hmm.
But not hard to make in your own home if
mm-hmm.
you had to. So these folks are still doing that. They still... But of course, they still have a connection
mm-hmm.
and a memory about the things that they left behind. They haven't tried making Hot Pockets yet.
Probably a good thing. But anyway, this town is pretty self-sufficient, but there's still things they need. I mean, there's a lot of trade goods that, in some ways, the economy is sort of picking up a little bit. And when I read this, I was almost reminded of, those books by Fernand Braudel about...
The structures of everyday life.
Yes, because he goes into detail about how all these little things just kind of added up and you had new civilization kind of growing out of the old. And so... For one reason or another, this feudal lord, Mr. Bullock, is no longer sending his little boat down to Albany to pick up goods, and so the townspeople have to do it themselves.
Yeah, they have to get their own boat now. And,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, in my imagined world, you know, the capital city of Albany, New York, has once again become a trading center.
Mm-hmm.
The state government's not functioning, but mm-hmm. but it's become a trade center on the Hudson River, and it, you know, with its connections to the Erie Canal and the Champlain Canal going to Canada, and trade goods are exchanged there. And my boys go down in a boat, and they have an adventure down there.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that's indeed what happens.
Well, Albany.
It's interesting that you should mention Braudel, mm-hmm. the great French historian and sort of geographer, economics writer, because I'm reading another one of his books right now.
Oh, really? Wow.
The Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
one of his earlier books. But mm-hmm. yeah, Braudel was he was the great historian of European economies.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a really vivid sense of how people lived in different times through reading him.
Well, so, you know, Albany has been, in one of your earlier novels, Albany was really kind of pretty down and out. In fact, there was this one guy who claimed to be representing the governor. He was sitting all alone in sort of half-destroyed governor's mansion. But
state capitol building.
Yeah, okay. But now yeah. Albany is back to its original
purpose.
No,
it's not back to its original size
no.
at all.
But its purpose.
It is coming back. Mm-hmm. You know, it's coming back more as a commercial mm-hmm. and trading and shipping center. But it's not the Albany of New York of today.
Mm-hmm.
With its whirring expressways and businesses and corporations and all that stuff's gone.
Mm-hmm. So these
just a waterfront town now.
Yeah. So these people,
as was Buffalo, as it was described in the previous mm-hmm. third installment of the series,
mm-hmm.
which is called A History of the Future.
Yes. Well, and then the rest of the country. Well, we in the other novel, we have in the South, you have the Foxfire Republic, and then in the deeper South, you have the New Africa Republic, and they're sort of at war, and.
Yeah.
Then you have what's left of the federal government up there in Michigan.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in the books, we learn. We don't. I was kind of parsed out the information about what was going on in the mm-hmm. United States, but also deliberately to give the reader the sense that the characters themselves would have gotten very sketchy information about what mm-hmm. was going on in the country. We do know a couple of things. We know that some kind of a dirty bomb went off in Washington that created a great deal of havoc
mm-hmm.
and actually kind of shut down and derailed the federal government and sent it, trying to reestablish itself in various cities and failing to do it. And also we learned that there's another bomb of some kind went off in Los Angeles that created a great deal of havoc. But information is very hard to get by because the electronic media are no longer running. Some newspapers, some broadsheet newspapers have been reestablished
mm,
around the country.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about it. So it's hard to get information about what's going on. And yeah, the Foxfire Republic featured kind of at the center of the previous novel, A History of the Future. And the leader of that outfit was a lady who had been a former country western singer and a TV evangelist. And her name was Loving Morrow.
Mm-hmm.
That was her stage name, anyway, and
mm-hmm.
political name. And I like to describe her as Dolly Parton meets Hitler. she was at the center of the third novel, but now we're beyond that. We're back in Union Grove.
Mm-hmm. So then you have tell us more about, you have this the Berkshire People's Republic, and they seem like a horror tale, sort of the quintessential left-wing crazies.
Well, it's interesting that I was actually writing this book at exactly the time that the social justice warrior hysteria broke out on the campuses across America.
Mm-hmm.
And, what we're seeing are this strange spectacle of young people acting like the Maoists did in 1966 during the Chinese Cultural Revolution, where you know, young people went around the countryside persecuting college professors and you know, anybody actually in authority. You know, they'd march them around in dunce caps and kill them sometimes. So the young people of today are you know, getting to that point of extreme intolerance with any ideas they disagree with. And the rational side of America is not fighting back very strenuously. You know, they're kind of just taking it. Anyway, it was an odd coincidence that I was writing this book kind of at the same time that this was going on. And so the villains in this book are basically, you know, crazed social justice warriors from Western Massachusetts who have come to, you know, sort of take advantage of these poor schnooks living in a very isolated little village in, across the state line in New York.
Well, my question was, when I first came across them, read about them, is I wonder, how do these people survive? Because they don't really have many skills, and they seem completely out of touch with reality. So how do they survive? Apparently by grifting, but they're not very good at that either.
Well, in this case, they get kind of, they get stopped.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, clearly they're also, they've been plundering, you know, they've been plundering farms and stealing stuff, and you know, that's pretty much what they're doing.
That's kind of, it seems to be unsustainable in a way.
Well, we'll see, you know. We'll see. The thing about fiction, as opposed to writing nonfiction, is you don't have to be correct about everything. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is be plausible. And I like to flatter myself to think that I succeeded in suspending the disbelief of the reader. And persuading them that they have entered a world that is a believable world. And so, you know, we'll see how the readers feel about it. I've only started to get some you know, response from them. And for the most part, it's been pretty positive. So, so I don't know. But, you know, I think the main thing is, you know, the previous book in the series, the villains were the extreme right-wing teabagger types. And in this one, the villains are the extreme left-wing social justice warrior types. You know, I think both types are doing enormous damage to our politics and our culture. But that's where we are today in this somewhat crazy, in this republic gone mad.
Well, actually, you know, you don't have to be a lefty to propagate funny money. I mean, you know, that's what our government does. It's sort of imaginary money, and they... so the scam is that these people come and they're going to, you know, revive civilization and build roads and all this kind of stuff. And you turn in your silver and we'll give you our Berkeley script. And and so they keep the silver and I guess they try to go on from there. But it doesn't work out, does it?
No, they're kind of, you know, they're basically, you know, scavenging the countryside for chumps. And but we don't know. I mean, the book ends, and it ends when it ends, and the series ends when it ends. And you know, I can't really forecast how things are going to be another 5 or 10 years ahead in this imaginary world, because I'm now leaving it behind.
Well, you got anything else in mind, or what?
I'm going in the other direction. I'm halfway through a book right now, basically a hippie novel.
Okay.
1968.
And
I'm having a lot of fun with it, and it's a lot of fun to go back in time to the, you know, the days when there were no telephone answering machines and everybody smoked cigarettes, and you know, life was real different. So.
Well, I've been wondering about the future of the internet.
You know, the internet is completely dependent on a reliable telephone. Reliable electric grid. And everybody assumes that that will be with us forever. And in fact, the electric grid in America is really pretty old and fragile, and in need of at least $500 billion worth of work to just keep it going the way it is. Not to mention, you know, making it bigger or better or more safer or less fragile. So, you know, the prospects that we're going to not have problems with the electric grid are pretty small.
Well, I've been wondering about, you know, as far as these sort of these three economic models in this story, I kind of wonder about the future of feudalism. You know, it's like you know, Bullock's plantation is sort of running pretty well, and he eats well. But I'm wondering how sustainable that is, because he takes in people who really have no skills, or their skills are obsolete, and he puts them to work, and he's created this kind of vibrant little economy.
Well, he's teaching them skills.
Right.
And they are being taught skills, let's put it that way.
Right.
You know, they're basically people who had office jobs in the old times, and in these new times where agriculture is the central endeavor in the economy, they're reacquiring agricultural skills and learning how to manage crops and animals and the things that are needed to do that. And, you know, they're getting on pretty well. You know, I'm not necessarily a proponent of feudalism, but... this world, this fictional world I've created, is a world in which almost all authority has been eliminated, and all institutional stuff has been eliminated. You know, people in our time hang their lives on this armature, this institutional armature of, you know, school or corporate culture or government or, you know, or the courts, and all of these things have ceased to function. In the world made by hand. So, you know, they can hang their lives on the things that remain, which are the church. They don't necessarily have to be pious, but, you know, it's the only local organization that brings people together. Or in the case of Bullock's Plantation, you know, a very well-organized feudal operation.
But then I think, well, my...
People give their allegiance to Bullock in exchange for, you know, a purposeful life, a role in a small society, and physical safety.
But you wonder that as they gain skills, and then as there's all this land available, you think maybe they might start to leave the plantation and set up their own thing going.
Well, I think you're getting a little ahead of yourself in terms of the history of the future, which has not happened yet, but, you know, that's possible. What you say is possible, and certainly, you know, we see that societies in history are basically emergent organisms. You know, they grow and transfigure themselves the way, let's say, you know, a flower grows and efflorescens, and they're self-organizing, and, you know, you go from one, you know, in European history, we went from the feudal years to the Renaissance.
Well, I hear my music.
And that was the transition that we went through for various reasons.
Well, I hear my music playing, and I'm kind of sad to see the end of this series of novels, you know. It's the latest book is The Harrows of Spring, and I've been talking with James Howard Kunstler, the author, and you can get that book. And you have a blog that people can read. We can't say the name of it on the air, but people can just...
Yeah, it's a little bit salty.
Yeah, so
but,
people can...
It's at www.kunstler.com, K-U-N-S-T-L-E-R.com.
Okay, well, thank you.
Every Monday morning.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much for being with us, James Howard Kunstler.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for reading my book.
Oh, you bet. Yeah, I wish there were more.
Thanks.
Bye.